I'm Christopher Lydon. Here's the Easter week puzzle. The man who put the first lash to Jesus in the Christian story and sent him to his death is strangely not the villain of the piece. Pontius Pilate is the man who washed his hands of the killing of Jesus. He was the Roman governor in Hebrew Judea who said, "I find no fault with this man," though he scourged Jesus nonetheless because it was politically convenient, and then he crucified him. Having done the deed, he was the righteous coward who presumed to declare, "I am innocent of the blood of this just person." But can he be? Pilate seems rather a guilty bystander, sensible and gutless, a necessary chump in the cast. There's no courage in his conviction that Jesus is falsely accused. There's no boldness in his order to kill. The cautionary politician, the equivocator, the modern man at the trial of Jesus, Pontius Pilate, and the weight of his story in our own world are next as the conversation continues. Audio streaming was provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting came from Elsa Dorfman, Boston's Matthew Brady. Details available at elsa.photo.net. And from Harvey Silverglade, co-author of The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty on America's Campuses, now in paperback from Harper Perennial Books. Also from the artist Michael Mazur, whose show The Prince of Michael Mazur is at the Minneapolis Institute of Art this spring. And from the 1999 Bollingen poet Robert Creeley, Trust to Good Verses Then. I'm Christopher Lydon. In our guest Anne Rose narrative, the man who killed Jesus was a mixture of dozens of invented men, each symbolic of something. Pontius Pilate is a symbol of the state. He's the secular power, the material world. He is ignorance and darkness, she writes. He is all men facing, considering, and ultimately rejecting truth. Pontius Pilate was no faceless bureaucrat, though, in Anne Rose's rather speculative biography. He was an ambitious politician, loyal to the Emperor Tiberius, eager to extend his own career beyond provincial Judea, but then caught up in the culture clash between Romans and Jews. In the whole cast of gospel characters, he's the man who's still around, the man we all recognize, who knows better but doesn't stand up. We're talking about Pontius Pilate this Easter week. Do you have your own idea who this man was and who he represents? Could it be you or me? Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair says that Pontius Pilate commands our moral attention not because he was a bad man, but because he was so nearly a good man. Our phone is 617-450-2923. That's 617-450-2923. Welcome, Anne Rowe, and thank you for this book. Why do we care about Pontius Pilate so much, and why did you care so much about him?
Why did I care? I think we still care tremendously about Pontius Pilate because he represents ourselves. As you said in the introduction, he is all of us facing God and not sure what to do about it. I think we've all had occasion when we suspect that we may be being challenged by God or by challenged by our better selves to do the right thing, but it's too uncomfortable to do it. It's too difficult. We'd rather not, so we look the other way. The other reason that Pilate is so familiar to all of us is he seems to be the archetypal modern politician, the man who shifts between expedience and his duty. You know, he knows what he ought to do. He's not quite brave enough to do it. He'd rather take an opinion poll, find out what people think. He's worried about his job. We know so many Pilates. And we're Pilates ourselves.
He washes his hands, famously. I mean, is that where we get the whole notion of washing our hands of
things? The whole notion of passing the buck, all the rest of it, yes, you know.
Taking a poll?
taking a poll.
Triangulating opinion.
That's right. All these shifty things that politicians do.
What were the consequences for him? I mean, he washed his hands, but you have an interesting... I mean, a lot of fantasy takes outside the Gospels on what it meant to him in the end. What do you think?
I don't believe it meant very much to him. I don't believe he came away from the trial thinking, my goodness, what have I done? I think it was probably an overwhelming sense of relief. I've got this troublemaker off my hands. What we do have, though, I always feel is a moment of hesitation in the trial, this golden moment, if you like, when he's suddenly informed by the Jewish high priests that this was the Son of God, or he had said he was the Son of God, and Pilate, I think, suddenly thinks, my goodness, perhaps this man is a god, perhaps he has come down, I can't afford to ignore this man. There's that just that moment when I think he does begin to regret what he's doing and he wants to wriggle out of it. He tries to release him quite hard at that point, but then all his worldly cares crowd in again. What's more important is he keeps his job, he keeps the peace, all these pragmatic considerations crowd in, and suddenly he's...
Actually, I mean, there are several wriggling moments there, including his wife's warning. I mean, I always get her mixed up with Caesar's wife, but Pilate's wife says, I've had a dream about this guy. You don't want to have anything to do with trouble around him. He's haunting me already.
This is a very interesting incident, in fact, of Pilate's wife, because it's interpreted in two completely different ways through history. We know the incident in the Gospels, in Matthew's Gospel, where she tries, as you say, to stop the trial. And so we imagine that this wife is a rather saintly creature who's trying to do what maybe we would want to do and save Jesus. In the Middle Ages, they had a completely different interpretation of her dream. Pilate's wife was a sort of floozy, and she was set upon by the devil while she was asleep. And it's the devil who says, please stop this trial. We don't want this man crucified. If he saves humanity, that's the end of my power over mankind, so please stop the trial. There you are, she can either be a goodie or a baddie.
There's so many ways to tell this story. Part of it is that he is this kind of necessary villain for death, resurrection, redemption, transformation of the world to happen. Somebody's got to pull the trigger.
There's got to be someone. If this is a divine plan unfolding, and Christians believe it is, this is God's great plan to redeem mankind, sending his son must die. Human agents have got to perform the deed. Now, which human agent? If you look through the Old Testament and see how the death of Jesus is prefigured, it's always on a cross. There's always this symbol of the cross. It's the brass serpent raised by Moses in the desert. It's the Passover lamb that's kind of crosswise on the spit. There's always the symbol of the cross. That's how Jesus is going to die. If it's a cross, it has to be a Roman, has to be a Roman governor who executes him. So it's going to fall to the poor guy who happens to be in charge, you know, when Jesus is on earth and ready to die.
There are these strange moments, as you say, when the story could go different ways, and there are warnings of the huge consequences here. One of them, I mean, one of the strange things about Pilate is that he, although he's a rather ordinary soldier bloke in certain respects, he's the only person on the scene who actually has a kind of philosophical exchange with Jesus. He's the only one who's listening, and he's the only one who's struck that Jesus doesn't say anything in answer to questions. But he does, at some point, Jesus says, in effect, and I shouldn't be paraphrasing, but he says, people who hear the truth know who I am. And Pilate, who may suspect the truth here, says, one presumes it sort of contemptuously, what is truth?
Yes.
But it's a big question.
It's the big question. It's an enormous question. I don't think he meant it in quite such a large way as we imagine. Because to a Roman, the philosophical question, what is truth, didn't have to do with religion at all. It was not a question about God. It was a pretty practical question. I think he meant, you know, what are you telling me what truth is? You tell me what truth is. He's throwing back the question at him. It is contempt, I think, as you say, that's in this question. It's not a deep wish to know what the truth is. It's, you know, he hasn't got time for a dissertation on truth. He doesn't want to know, I think, at that point.
You could wonder why Jesus doesn't want to tell him.
You could too. And, you know, it's often been thought maybe he doesn't want to put something as dangerous as truth into the hands of this Roman governor. He could tell him, but he won't, because what would he do with it?
We're talking about the Roman governor presiding at the trial of Jesus almost 2,000 years ago with Anne Rowe, who is an editor of The Economist magazine, has been working for a long time on this, bringing all the fragments of the Pontius Pilate story into a biography. A lot of it from the Gospels that we all know, but a lot of it from later sources, medieval sources, Victorian sources, modern sources. Who was this rather scared, becalmed coward at the trial who said, "He's a just man, but I'm going to take the first lash myself and put him to death in the Roman mode"? Pontius Pilate. Our phone is 617-450-2923. Jim Carroll is on the line, author of the bestseller Constantine's Sword, which revisits all the dimensions of this trial story. Jim Carroll, why do we care about Pontius Pilate so much? And you do.
Good morning, Chris. Good morning, Ms. Rowe.
Good morning, Jim.
It's true. I completely grasp why Ms. Rowe should be inviting us to reflect on the centrality of this mythic figure. Of course, from my point of view, having just completed a work focused on the conflict between Christians and Jews, the thing that strikes me as most compelling and problematic about Pilate, of course, is the way in which his figure in the Passion narrative is used, one could almost say polemically, by the authors of the Passion narrative as a way not so much of demonstrating his virtue or his relative virtue, but as a way of demonstrating the true villainy of the Jews. After all, the scene where he washes his hands, announcing that the blood of this innocent man will not be on his hands, the dramatic purpose of that moment is to stand in contrast to what happens next, which is, as Matthew remembers it, the crowd declaring, "His blood be upon us and upon our children," which is, of course, the foundational, almost totemic proclamation of Christian anti-Semitism. So Pilate's innocence is at the service of Jewish villainy, as I read the story. I wonder what Ms. Rowe makes of that, or whether the Christian invention, I say Christian here, of course, understanding that the Gospel writers themselves were Jews, that the Christian invention of this Pilate figure is really and mainly at the service of denigration of Jews. Ms. Rowe, what do you make of that?
Well, Jim, I think there's a great deal in what you say. It has obviously, that this particular incident of Pilate washing his hands and this awful chorus of the Jews back to him, which I think is completely invented, has obviously been at the service, as you say, of anti-Semitism all through the centuries. I mean, the Gospels are obviously very much too kind to Pilate. I think they do, in fact, try to show a bit of virtue in him just because he hesitates to crucify Jesus. And I'm sure there was not half so much hesitation, or even, you know, only the tiniest amount, that he would have been not only, you know, quite pleased to crucify Jesus, but also it was always his decision. He was the man who had the power. And I think just as invidious as that chorus of the Jews about his blood being upon us is the fact that I think in a couple of the Gospels, he's handed over to the Jews to be killed. I mean, this is most ridiculous. He was not handed over to the Jews. Yeah. It was the Romans who took him to be crucified.
Right.
The whole thing was a Roman execution.
Right.
And I think the blame falls solidly on Pilate, in fact, you know, even if you read the Gospels as they were written.
Yeah.
But, of course, it's been interpreted the way Christians have chosen to interpret it, and they have wanted to blame the Jews. You know, the character of Pilate has played to their worst instincts.
Well, you know, as we recall the composition of the Gospels taking place 50 and 60 years after the event, of course, and when the Romans are put into the role of the relative benign figure, that is to say, the Romans, even though they are complicit in the death of Jesus, they do find a way to affirm basic Christian claims that are being made for Jesus by the years 70, 80, 90, when the Gospels are written. For example, Pilate is one bracket in Matthew. Another bracket is The closing bracket really is after the death of after the literal death of Jesus. A Roman centurion is remembered as having as saying, "Truly, this man was the Son of God."
Yes, the Romans are always the. I'm sorry, Chris.
No, I was just going to say. I think I owe this to your book, Jim. But I mean, the point that it's the two Romans around this story,
yes.
Pilate and the centurion. It's Pilate who certifies the innocence of Jesus, and it's the centurion who certifies the divinity of
right.
Jesus. They do get to sort of speak with that very imperial
right.
seal of a kind of truth.
Yes.
Before, I want to go back to the moment of truth there and just play. We began the hour with a fragment of Bach's St. Matthew Passion, but I want to hear a moment from the St. John Passion of Johann Sebastian Bach, where Pilate asks Jesus, "What is truth?"
Spricht Pilatus zu ihm, was ist Wahrheit? Und da das gesaget, ging wieder hinaus zu den Juden und spricht zu ihnen. Ich finde keine Schuld an ihm. Ihr habt aber eine Gewohnheit, dass ich euch einen losgebe. Wollt ihr nun, dass ich euch der Jüden König losgebe?
Da schrien sie wieder allesamt und sprachen,
nicht diesen, diesen nicht, nicht diesen sollten Barabbas, nicht diesen sollten Barabbas.
That's the Jewish mob saying, no, don't spare Jesus, let Barabbas go. And again, I mean, the villainy does go to the Jews. On the other hand, I mean, I'd like you both to sort of answer the question, what is Pilate's responsibility in Orthodox Christian thinking? He is, I mean, in the Catholic creed that's recited at every Mass, they speak of Jesus suffering and dying under Pilate.
Yes.
So he's not off the hook.
No, it's nope. quite clear. It's quite, and you know, the Christian tradition is ambivalent on the question of the death of Jesus. Actually, you could say, what's the word for a three-way ambivalence, Chris? I'm sure you know.
It's
tribivalent. Because
no,
the death
tribulence.
Of Jesus was put to death first and foremost in the Passion narrative by the will of the Jews. Second, by the Romans, whose execution device was used. But then thirdly, in the theological tradition, by all of us sinners. And that's been those three notes have been struck repeatedly down through the years. Of course, we never quite reconcile that with the theological affirmation to which Ms. Rowe just referred a moment ago, which is that all of this is playing out in one theological tradition, the will of God. So it's as if at various points in history we associate the death of Jesus with one, the other, or the other. The basic question to Christians, of course, is why does the death of Jesus matter so much, which is a separate question, but it's an important one.
Yes, I think it's an important point you raised, Jim, that it's all of us, too, who are supposed to contribute to the death of Jesus, you know, not just the Jews, not just the Romans, but every single one of us, and continually, even now.
Why isn't Pilate, in that sense, a perfectly good representation of all of us cowards, all of us equivocators?
Well, you could say he is, and he is also in the way in which he's left off the hook, and the Jews firmly remain on the hook, which at various points in history has, of course, been the source of such sad and sorry behavior on the part of Christians. But, you know, you could argue that Pilate is the living definition of what Hannah Arendt talked about when she described the banality of evil.
Yes, I agree with you, Jim. He's an extraordinarily ordinary Roman bureaucrat, really, which is part of the poignance of his story, I think, that here he is somebody who doesn't seem to me particularly intelligent, who's a soldier rather than a politician, certainly not a diplomat, who's in a very difficult job in Judea, and is suddenly faced with this extraordinary man who's on trial before him and simply can't see that and can only keep the instincts of a very ordinary man scared about his job. And I think, yes, that phrase of Hannah Arendt does come through rather clearly in his case.
Our phone is 617-450-2923. We're talking about Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor who presided at the trial of Jesus, with Jim Carroll and Anne Rowe, who's written a biography of Pontius Pilate. Jim, I wanted to just take the opportunity to ask you, because you're a novelist as well as a historian and a religious writer, what could you make of this character?
Well, two things, Chris. I think as a dramatist, you see him as the perfect figure, which is why I think he has such a central place in our imagination. The drama of the gospel, I mean, just looking at it as a literary work, the drama of the gospel requires that Jesus be rejected by his own people, not by Rome, just because the story is so much more powerful when the rejection comes from his own. That's what makes it tragic, as in the line in John, his own knew him not. The story wouldn't have the bite if it were a story about Jesus being rejected by Rome, because after all, Rome was in the business of rejecting the claims of people like Jesus. The other thing I would make as an historian, on the other hand, Chris, is one of the things we must always have in mind about Pilate is that he was this present symbol of an oppressive occupation force that was brutal beyond our imagining. It's in that context that we have to remember Pilate. Don't forget that the Romans occupied what we might call the region of Palestine in about 63 before the Common Era, so 63 years before Jesus was born. The Roman occupation army comes in on Palestine, and you just simply must think, as an analogy, the German army occupying France in 1940. It's that kind of occupation. The people of Palestine, the people of Israel, were restless and rejecting of the Roman dominance, unlike many other peoples who found ways to accommodate Roman occupation. And that's the story, beginning in that year, 63 before Jesus, right up to the year 135 in the Common Era. The Roman oppression of Israel was ruthless. The Roman wars against the Jewish people led to the deaths, Josephus says, of something like 1.5 million people. And that was all taking place before, during, and after the lifetime of Jesus. Josephus reports that in the year that Jesus was born, 2,000 rebellious Jews were crucified by the Roman local Roman governor in one season. That is to say, when Mary and Joseph were visiting Jerusalem and Bethlehem, there were 2,000 crosses on the road in and out of Jerusalem. Not three tidy crosses the way we Christians think of it. 2,000 crosses. Josephus makes the point that these rebels were crucified. That's what Romans did to anyone who rejected their authority.
Well, Jim, I'll come in here because I do feel you slightly over-exaggerate the picture here. I mean, the Romans got very much worse in their governorship of Judea leading up to the wars, but mainly at the time of Pilate, I think they were more like a police presence than like an army of occupation. I mean, they were not at all like the Nazis in France, except, if you like, the south of France, where they were more or less sort of colluding with the population and just a sort of a force of authority. I mean, I am very struck when I read the Gospels by how little the Romans are mentioned. I mean, they're hardly mentioned at all, as if they're only off on the side and Jewish life is proceeding more or less as normal. You know, people are harvesting their crops, people are going about their business, they're worshipping.
Well, in this story also, Pilate and Herod become friends around the trial of Jesus.
Well, they do work together. I mean, the Romans and the chief priests always had to work together until it became impossible, because they were both intent on keeping the peace.
But everything we know of the history, wouldn't you agree, Ms. Rowe, suggests that while the Gospels were written, Roman brutality was at its most present. You're talking, of course, about the year 30 when we're talking about Pilate, but these gospel texts are composed between 68, 69, and the year 100.
They are, and then the governors
of course, after, and 70 is when the savage leveling of Jerusalem takes place.
I agree, but, you know, if we're talking about Pilate, it was not a particularly savage rule that he put into Judea. I think he was really not a particularly bad governor by the standards of the very bad governors later, just before the Jewish wars.
But then the question, it seems to me, in the telling of all this story, Jim, is why did the gospel narratives become so lenient about the Romans.
Well, speaking with the humility of someone who doesn't really know, I don't think any of us really know, but I understand it as for two things. One is, as all Jews would have, they took the venality of the Roman Imperium utterly for granted, A, and B, they were not concerned to challenge it explicitly or directly. They were determined to render unto Caesar, partly because they knew very well what the Roman response was capable of. After all, Christians had been martyred in some numbers under Nero in 63 and 64, unjustly scapegoated for the fire, apparently. So the followers, the Jewish followers of Jesus in those years, are not making a case against Rome, even though they're affirming belief in the one God, which is a fundamental resistance to Rome. And they're much more concerned, I believe, because Rome was so efficient as a ruler, they had successfully gotten their the client peoples to compete with each other. I think that the Christians were experiencing their fellow Jews as their main problem at that point,
all of them taking
for granted the Roman venality.
And Ro, does that make sense to you?
Yes, I think that makes sense. I mean, it's certainly clear that the early Christians have no reason, they don't want to put Roman backs up, they don't want to do anything but make themselves palatable to Rome, I think. And it's noticeable in the story of Pilate that as soon as the Romans embrace Christianity in the 4th century, the figure of Pilate becomes more and more villainous from then on, as if he's only been made at all soft in order to get the Romans on the side of the Christians. As soon as there's no need to do that, suddenly this character takes an extreme dive until by the Middle Ages you have a figure who's on the stage alongside Satan and every bit as bad as both the devil and it medievalized the Jews. So, you know, that's an interesting progression in the story.
Indeed so.
But what does one do then with the sort of, what you're saying was a kind of political or almost marketing pressure on the gospel writers to bend the story in Pilate's favor? What is a modern Christian like yourself, James Carroll, you know, do with that bit of sort of storytelling, the story of the story?
Well, I've heard, I've been instructed on this program over the years, Chris, by John Dominic Crossan, who helps us remember that the gospel writers are not falsifying history. That is to say, they're not saying Pilate was innocent when they knew very well he wasn't. They're really recording a story as they remember the history. I mean, this is the way the story had come to them and was coming to them while they were in competition with their fellow Jews. So it's not so simple as saying the Gospels lie about this, about these events. I think what we're really getting is Gospel writers who are telling the story as they understand it. And this, don't forget, it's very important to always keep in mind, the Gospels are not written as history by eyewitnesses. They're not written by people, that is to say, who were there. Nobody who writes the Gospels was present for any of these trials that are reported in such detail. We clearly have invention here. It may be invention based on oral tradition or not. We don't know. But what's important for our purposes is to understand that the radical conflict between Jesus and the Jews, so-called, reflects a conflict that was taking place between the followers of Jesus and other Jews who were rejecting their claims. That's important because it enables us to understand that Jesus himself never set himself against the Jewish people, which is that's key to our ability to undoing the centuries of Christian anti-Judaism.
Jim Carroll, we'll come back to it after a short break. We're talking about Pontius Pilate this week with Anne Rowe, who's written the biography, and James Carroll, who wrote the bestseller Constantine's Sword. I want to come back to all of those sort of questions of history of the narrative, Jim Carroll, but also to just the figure of Pilate himself and to a rather marvelous interview in which Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of England, kind of embraced him as a kind of exemplary politician, exemplary of all the temptations, all the faults, all the dilemmas, all the missed opportunities, but sort of a challenge to each of us, to every man, even now. Our phone is 617-450-3733. 2923. Give us a call as the conversation continues. 617-450-2923. Talking this hour about the governor presiding at the trial of Jesus, Pontius Pilate. Audio streaming was provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting came from Suzanne and Bob Petrucci from Pajato Systems Group, specializing in Java and Linux-based multi-tier application development, www.pajato.com, and from the poet Gail Mazur, whose fourth collection, They Can't Take That Away From Me, published by the University of Chicago Press, is available at amazon.com.
So you are the king of the Jews.
King's your word.
Well, you are Jesus of Nazareth, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Well, that's what they're saying. You are the king, the Messiah. It's also said that you do miracles. Is this good magic or bad magic? Could we have some kind of demonstration? I mean, can you do a trick for me now, say?
No, I'm not a trained animal. I'm not a magician.
Well, that's disappointing. This means that you're just another Jewish politician. Do you want to know something? You're more dangerous than the zealots. Do you know that? Say something. You had best to say something.
From Martin Scorsese's movie, The Last Temptation of Christ, that was David Bowie playing Pontius Pilate, asking for a trick, and in the Gospels he does want a miracle, and Jesus famously not responding to his question. We're talking about Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, in the Gospels presiding and washing his hands at the trial and death penalty, the sentencing of Jesus, with Anne Rowe, who's written a marvelous book with a lot of imagination in it, called Pontius Pilate, also with James Carroll. Join the conversation at 617-450-2923. 617-450-2923. Christer Stendahl is on the line, formerly Bishop of Sweden, also former Dean of the Harvard Divinity School. Christer Stendahl, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Why do we care about Pontius Pilate, and who is he to you?
I liked it very much when Ms. Rowe said that most of the things that we hear Pilate say, like, what is truth, ecce homo, see the man, that we of course hear these with the kind of cosmic echo through the ages, but they are really just low-key casual things, and the casuality, even the banality of Pilate, is what is, of course, always lost because it is in the Bible. And I think it's important to to stress as has been by her, the rather average kind of Roman type that he was. And that leads me to ask her whether what is really her basis for this hesitation on Pilate's part. She makes him into a kind of Roman skeptic, and isn't that really to read exactly the things that Jim Carroll spoke about, namely the moving of the responsibility from Pilate to the Jews, and that is what gives us the impression of his hesitation. But I would like her to I read her book over a year ago, and I wondered whether this psychologizing of him, which is wonderful, as I love the book, is that, what is the basis for that, other than that thing that just Jim Carroll described?
I can try to tell you what it is. I was very struck by an incident earlier in Pilate's career that's described by Josephus, the incident of the standards, when he takes the military standards into Jerusalem. And as you remember, the Jews all come out to the palace and protest for 5 days, down and lie down in front of the palace to force him to take the standards down, and Pilate won't do it. And then in the very end, he says, you know, go home or I'll cut you down. And they lie down in front of him and say, you know, okay, cut us down, we don't care, our God is stronger than your God, words to that effect, or actions to that effect. Mm-hmm. And this has an extraordinary effect on Pilate. I mean, Josephus says he was astonished, and he rescinded his order, and the standards were brought back. And I think at that moment, it seems to me, he's suddenly faced with a God who's stronger than his God. Now, it seems to me, from all the archaeological evidence we know about Pilate, which, as you know, is very little, we do know that he was an emperor worshipper, as close as you could be at that time, and that his god really was Tiberius. And at this moment, he seems to realize there's another god here I'm dealing with. And I wonder if that hesitation, I mean, it is purely a speculation, I have to admit, if at the point...
It's a wonderful speculation, but as a biblical scholar, I'm always suspicious of those who take a source like Josephus as sort of solid truth, while the Bible has all kinds of tendencies behind it. Josephus also had an agenda.
I agree, but I take them both in the same spirit, which is that I just take their story, and I see if each of those stories somehow contributes to the psychology of Pilate as we've understood it since. I mean, I do try to make allowances, I hope, for both their biases and both their lack of historical accuracy, if you like. But it seemed to me that in that moment of astonishment that Pilate has with the standards, you have a similar moment in the trial. And, you know, if you can have the one moment, then you can perhaps have the other moment. It's still a perhaps, you know, maybe he wasn't astonished at either time. But
James Carroll, because I know we have to let you go, I just want you to correct the record to the extent that one can edit the Gospels. If Pontius Pilate has been let off the hook and given a suspended sentence here that he didn't really deserve, how would you correct the record?
Well,
and what is his guilt?
I think that the Christian memory has to recover the broad political and social context within which the Jesus story unfolds, and that is, by and large and overwhelmingly, really, a story of a Roman war against the Jewish people. Ms. Rowe is right to point out that that's not the case in the year 30, a relatively benign period. But certainly by the time the Gospels are being written, after the destruction of the temple and the leveling of Jerusalem in 70, the Roman War is the context against which all of this unfolds. And it's in that context that I think we have to take the figure of Pilate as presented in the Gospels somewhat skeptically. But I am grateful for the chance to have been part of this conversation with Ms. Rowe and Bishop Stendhalen. Thank you to you too, Chris.
Jim, it's a pleasure to have you on our air. Thank you, James Carroll, author of Constantine's Sword. Going back to your book, Anne Rowe, there's a longish quotation here from an interview with Tony Blair, in which he very openly kind of identifies with Pontius Pilate, and in a kind of indictment of himself or defense of Pilate, I'm not sure which, but he says, "It is possible to view Pilate as the archetypal politician caught on the horns of an age-old political dilemma. We know he did wrong, yet his is the struggle between what is right and what is expedient that has occurred throughout history. The Munich Agreement of 1938 was a classic example of this," he says, "as were the debates surrounding the Great Reform Act of 1832 and the Corn Laws. And it is not always clear," he says, "even in retrospect, what is, in truth, right. Should we do what appears principled, or what is politically expedient? Do you apply a utilitarian test, or what is morally absolute?" My word, I mean, he makes a lot of common ground with the man who killed Jesus.
Yes, I was very struck by that. And also, I don't think the quote begins with the remark he made beforehand, which was to say, you know, there are three important characters in the Easter story, and the first is Pontius Pilate. It's obvious this is the character who most appeals to him. Of course, here in Tony Blair, we've got the architect of the famous Third Way, where you don't take one side, you don't take the other, you always
try. This is your brand of Clintonism, yeah.
Well, I think Clinton borrowed it from us, but you try and take this path straight through the middle. Another very interesting point, when my book came out in Ireland, there were a number of reviews that treated Pilate as if he was still, not only still alive, but taking part in the Northern Ireland peace process, which, as you know, is second only to the Middle East in the difficulties of it. And the reviewers saw Pontius Pilate as either on one side or on the other side, but trying to sell both sides down the river, unprincipled politician, if you like, moving between the two sides and trying to cut any deal he could. And I was very surprised by how real he seemed to them and how much like all the politicians they felt they were dealing with. Not at all a historical figure. He was treated as if he was, you know, still there and as real as any of the negotiators in the peace process. So Pilate has not grown old.
Well, I think he serves wonderfully as a kind of warning, including a warning to the Tony Blairs of the world and the Bill Clintons and to all of us, to me and maybe even to you, Christa Stendahl. What do you think?
Yes, I mean it's the image of establishment, a secular establishment. You have the religious establishment pictured in the high priests, and you have this, and it's. I think that even what the high priest says in the Passion narrative, it's better that one man die for the people than that the Romans come and take away the little power we still have. Now that is a kind of decision that almost anybody in authority has made once in a time. But fortunately the cameras or the speakers were not on.
Jim Carroll, I'm not sure quite answered the question he raises is, you know, if he has been let off the hook too lightly and falsely proclaimed a kind of innocence, just what is Pilate guilty of? And what are we guilty of when we do the Pilate washing of hands? What is the sin, Christa Stendahl?
The sin is much more tragic. It's a way he is sort of calculating, and he is calculating wrong. He is often pictured as being afraid of what they will say in Rome, and I think there is some truth to that. He also perhaps is relatively interested in the real issue, and he makes a pragmatic decision. Now, the tragedy of the whole story is that his reasoning is so reasonable as the reasoning of the high priests are. And that is the tragedy. Evil is much more complicated than just people sitting and being evil.
Our phone is 617-450-2923. We're talking about Pontius Pilate in Easter Week. John is on the line from Poughkeepsie, New York.
Hello.
Welcome, John.
Thank you very much. I was actually interested in this. You were talking earlier about the possible reason for hesitation Pilate may have had. And I wonder if it was illustrated nicely by Martin Scorsese's film, the clip you played, where Jesus did not answer Pilate. He didn't play to those games. He didn't recognize that earthly authority, and Pilate was essentially rendered powerless. Whether Pilate was a bright man or not, here was a man that was in charge, was certainly in power, and by not recognizing that earthly authority, for the moment he was rendered powerless, and that must have been a bit of an eye-opener and caused a second glance. And when we think of the secular establishment or secularism in general, each of us who are not necessarily believers, to run into a person who is so willing to give their lives away for what would otherwise be a simple display or a simple pronouncement of guilty or not guilty regarding their own culpability.
Right.
Here's a person that was willing to do nothing, and that may have turned Pilate's head.
Yes, I think you're right, John. It would have really taken Pilate by surprise. He couldn't cope with this at all. I think the idea that this was a man who, as far as he knew, had claimed to be a king, although we think that may not be true, but here was someone who had some of the panoply of kingship about him, it was said, and yet he had no servants, he had no power, he had no robes, he had no appearance of a king, you know, even his physical appearance, Isaiah said, you know, there's nothing physically attractive about this man who was going to face the highest power there was. I mean, Pilate has no notion how to cope with somebody like this, and I think this comes over very clearly, actually, in paintings of the trial scene, where you always have Pilate. He's usually enthroned, isn't he, with all the panoply of Rome, with the eagles, with the marble, with all his robes, his attendants. And before him is this man who has nothing, just a plain robe, bare feet, he's beaten, and yet all the power is on Jesus' side. There isn't any on Pilate's. It's suddenly rendered useless by the spiritual strength of the man he faces.
John, well said.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The phone is 617-450-2923. I still want to locate, before we're done, the just exactly what's not ambivalent, what is deeply guilty about the Pilate reflex. You say, and that he is all men, facing, considering, and ultimately rejecting or abandoning truth.
I think that's the essence of what the Pilate sin is, if it is a sin, is the failure to recognize God wherever God may be speaking to us or in whatever person he may be present, because it's often just too difficult for us to do so. It's too challenging, it's too uncomfortable. You know, we know we ought to act in the right way, but we don't dare, we don't want to. We carry on with our lives as normal. We haven't actively done anything wrong, but we have failed to do what's right. I think that's the Pilate error, if you like, the Pilate sin, if you want to put it more strongly.
Christopher Stendahl, do you want to add to the sentence?
No, I think that's, if I wanted to be real difficult, I would say this was not a moral problem with Pilate. I think Pilate, under the circumstances, acted as a moral person. But the tragedy is that he was blind to the quality of Jesus, that it was his lack of sensitivity and perception, rather than moral in terms of being too selfish or this or that. And that gives the intensity to the story and the mystery of the Passion.
I don't think it lets him off the hook at all in the end. I think it makes him a thoroughly compelling modern challenge.
Or better to say, perhaps he had the chance to see something in Jesus that he didn't see. And that it has more with perception, ultimately with faith, than it has to do with. And when the creed says that he was crucified under Pontius Pilate, many people argue that that doesn't mean that it was Pilate who did it, but that it is a temporal expression. It was during the time when Pilate was in charge. And even there, he is not the ultimately guilty one, but he missed it.
Yes, he did miss it, and I think one of the most striking things to us is that he missed it when he was standing so close to him, you know, when he was 3 feet away from Jesus. I mean, the sheer physical proximity of these two people, I think, is extraordinarily dramatic, because there is such a failure to communicate, not only because they don't understand each other, and they're probably not speaking each other's language, but they're going through interpreters, but, you know, also there's simply no common ground here. It's intensely dramatic.
Also, mythology grows up, as you write, outside the Gospels about what happened to Pontius Pilate, what price he paid. He confronts Jesus in dreamlike moments. Work that out. What was happening there in the sort of further imagining of this man's failure and the consequences of it?
It was certainly imagined in the early church that Pilate would have had to pay a heavy price for crucifying Jesus. And whether or not you had tried to let him off the hook, the early church writers certainly believed he would have had to die violently, according to divine justice, simply for having dared to put a god to death, for having dared to put God's son to death. And so all kinds of violent deaths were imagined for him. I mean, generally, he was supposed to have committed suicide, and I think this may be historically correct, because he was eventually recalled from Judea in disgrace, and that would have been...
But not for this?
Not for this, no, for having put down a revolt in Samaria rather too violently. The Samaritans complained, he was recalled, and then he disappears from history. It's possible that he
committed suicide. What's the authority
suicide?
That he might have committed suicide? And it leads also
merely
to the question
that this was quite a normal thing you did. If you were a Roman official, you'd fallen into disgrace. It was no dishonor to commit suicide. In fact, it was rather better for your family. There were fewer repercussions against them if you took yourself out of the picture. Or he might have been banished.
But then in the casting of this whole story, I mean, it equates him in a certain way with Judas, whose suicide is the ultimate sort of self-condemnation, and it's enormously freighted. Why not so with Pilate?
I think the difference is merely in the Roman culture that, Pilate, as is very, very likely, killed himself after being recalled, this was a fairly normal thing to do in the context of Roman officialdom. It carried none of the stigma that it has in the Christian church. Therefore, you know, we could say that Pilate killed himself, and it would not mean that he had, as you say, acknowledged his guilt as Judas did. It would not have any of that burden on it, simply because he was a Roman. We don't know what happened to Pilate at all. It's very likely, it's thought, that, you know, he may have died in other violent ways.
Christopher Stendahl, do you have a theory?
I have just a footnote to this, because it's one of the strengths, and it's wonderful to hear it again, when Anne Rowe really draws on her very deep understanding of Roman culture and places him in that. And it sounds so true, and it is so... One of the most beautiful things in the book is that whole culture comes to live. So she has rescued Pontius Pilate back to his Roman reality. And that's a great gift to us all.
Well, that's very kind of you to say that.
Thank you. Anne Rowe, sum it up. Who is he in our culture today, and who do we want him to be in our retellings of this story in our own lifetimes?
I always feel when I hear the story told again every Palm Sunday that Pilate is speaking for almost all the congregation, that all of us are somehow taking part in his dilemma, that he's always been someone who represents us. It's extraordinary that this has gone all through history, and that rather than trying to put ourselves in the place of Christ, as in a way the Gospels invite us to do, I suppose we feel we can't make that extraordinary leap, but we can put ourselves in the place of the man who doesn't recognize Christ, who's trying to work out who he is all through the trial. I mean, we are trying to work it out too. We're trying to come to the truth of this story. It's as if Christ is on trial in front of us, and we must work out our own conclusion, and we must in the end accept or reject. Perhaps we can remain ambivalent, but it's the same confrontation that we must go through.
Are we wrestling ourselves with the question of how we would have, whether we would have recognized divinity in Jesus and what we would have done about it?
Yes, I'm sure we are. And would we have known that he was the Son of God? I very much doubt it. I think we would have said, goodbye, I'm glad to see the back of you, you're causing me trouble. We'd just have taken the bureaucratic reaction to the scene, like Pilate did.
That's the warning. It's a marvelous book. And thank you, Anne Rowe, for sharing it with us. Pontius Pilate by Anne Rowe, spelled with a W, W-R-O-E, from Random House. Thank you. Thank you also,
thank you,
Jim Carroll, and thank you, Krista Stendahl. Thanks also to the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. Thanks also to New England Streaming Media and to Wayne Bennett and Andrew White at the Bingham Dana Law Firm in Boston. This program was produced in the BMP studios at the Christian Science Monitor by the team of Tom Tiger, Dan First, Hitesh Hatti, Catherine Bidwell, Amy McDonald, and Jake Shapiro. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. Johann Sebastian Bach is our staff composer. I'm Christopher Leiden. Please visit us at ChristopherLeiden.org.
Lass Jesum ein, wenn er